This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor dated Friday, February the 20th, 2026. We'll start, of course, in the world section of today's Monitor and work our way through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, our first headline from today's world section of the Monitor reads, "Medals aside, the women's Olympic free skate sparkled and soared." At the 2026 Milan Cortina Winter Games, Alisa Liu became the first American to win the women's free skate competition since Sarah Hughes in 2002. The date on this article is February the 20th. It is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at the Monitor, and the dateline is Milan, Italy. When Kaori Sakamoto looked back on her performance on Thursday night in the women's figure skating competition, she saw only one thing. Had she done one more rotation on one jump as planned, she would likely now be the 2026 Winter Olympic champion. And that is a shame. Not the result necessarily. Judges will judge by these finest of margins, and rightly so. It is a shame, rather, that Miss Sakamoto will leave these Olympics thinking she was anything short of incandescent. Medals are often an expression of the obvious. You score more goals than the other team or make it over the finish line faster, you win gold. But Thursday was one of those nights when it seemed a shame there had to be any medals at all. Yes, all the medals were thoroughly deserved, but there was also some sense among those who witnessed it that maybe gold, silver, and bronze amounted to less than the recognition of what had just happened, which was beautiful and wonderful, and just about as faultless as an Olympic figure skating competition can reasonably hope to be. Who would dare say anything to Ms. Sakamoto except thank you, or who could possibly watch Alisa Liu twirl and sparkle in her golden dress without cracking a smile to match her own? And it wasn't just the medalist, who included 17-year-old Japanese sensation Ami Nakai, who was so adorable that 100% of mothers polled said they wanted to give her a hug. There was American Amber Glenn, who made a medal-ending mistake in the short program but came back with a blockbuster free skate to finish fifth. And there was, yes, another Japanese skater, Mona Chiba, who finished fourth and can legitimately wonder how in the name of Dorothy Hamill did she not get an invite to the podium. Yet on this night, perhaps, that disappointment was a fraction less bitter because Ms. Liu was throwing a party and everyone was invited. And by everyone, we mean everyone. The skaters, the spectators in the crowd, and every viewer from San Francisco Bay Area to Siberia. It is possible that her sheer enthusiasm for everyone and everything registered on the Richter scale. This is not by coincidence. Ms. Liu was a figure skater at the 2022 Winter Olympics, and then she wasn't a figure skater at all. The simplest history is that she burned out and then came back on her own terms, which is both extremely mentally healthy and also gives the vague impression of a snowboarder who wandered into the wrong venue on the way to the slope-style competition. At an Olympic media summit in October, she fondly recalled the time she and her teammates were engrossed in the existential question, "Would you rather be a cow or a chicken?" She also achieved her signature frenulum piercing at home with her sister that secured two arrows in front of her teeth. She admitted out loud to journalists that she didn't really know why people like to watch figure skating. "We do the same routine over and over and wearing the same thing," she said. Her solution? "I wish I had a new outfit every competition." After Thursday's event, Ms. Liu was much more inclined to talk about her gold sequin dress. "If I fell on this jump, I would still be wearing this dress, so it's all good." Or the upcoming gala. "Let's talk about that," she said after becoming the first American to win the women's competition since Sarah Hughes in 2002. "I have a program that I am really excited to show. It's a really cool dress, like unlike any dress I have, so I'm super stoked with that." Perhaps we should have seen this coming with the hair. What even is that? A tiger? A skunk? A hairdresser malfunction? The internet suggests Ms. Liu was inspired by the rings of a tree, adding a new dyed layer every year. This apparently was a compromise solution after raccoon stripes proved impractical. I promise I'm not making this up. Has anyone in the history of sport ever competed with such utter irreverence for the enormity of the moment? And has that ever created a performance of such jolly abandon? It was unbelievable when I was done skating. When I was skating, hearing the cheers, I felt so connected with the audience, she said, before adding, "Oh, I want to be out there again." Together, the medalists made almost for a sitcom on states. There was Miss Sakamoto, the proper mother, showing everyone how things should be done. Her Japanese teammates actually call her Big Sister. There was Miss Liu, the college kid with the dyed hair and piercing out for her reckless joyride. And there was Miss Sakai as the little sister, wide-eyed and wondering if she was really there. I didn't really think of the pressure at all, Miss Sakai said with suitably innocent sincerity. I just skated it, the sport that I love, and that also helped out with being able to enjoy the skating. For Miss Sakamoto, the bitterness of the experience was hard to let go. I really wanted to skate perfectly here, she said, knowing that I couldn't and that it was the difference for the gold was painful. I couldn't stop the tears. But on the podium, Big Sister became the official arranger of the Olympic stoat mascots, making sure her fellow medalists had their stuffed Tina mascots lined up just so. At the press conference, she glided over to Miss Sakai to make sure her teammate had her earpiece correctly in place to hear the translator. Elegance, it seems, is not something she leaves on the ice. Nor is one rotation the best measure of a night when the world's best skaters gave those who watched something more memorable than the color of a medal. And again, this particular article is by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Moving on to our second article, still focused on the Olympics, this headline reads, "O Canada, the U.S. women won hockey gold, but you won hearts." The U.S. women's hockey team trounced Canada 5-0 in the preliminary round, but when the rivals met again in the Olympic gold medal match on Thursday, it was a different story. The date on this is February 20th, and it is also by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor, and the dateline is Milan, Italy. With one last flash of skill, the United States won gold on Thursday in the women's hockey final at the 2026 Winter Games. But the Canadians put in a performance that surely won hearts. On balance, the gold medal might have gone to the better team, the team that had, after all, won the previous five games against Canada by a combined total of 29-7. But on this night in Milan, the gold medalists were mostly second best to their greatest rivals. Canadian pride in hockey is not something to be trifled with, and certainly not the pride of a Canadian team like this, brimming with gold medalists and world champions. For the past five games, they had been hounded around the ice by a younger and faster American team. The question hung over Canada like a silver cloud. Had they brought the old gang back for one Olympics too many? But for 57 minutes and 57 seconds of Thursday's final, the answer was an emphatic no. Veteran savvy made America's talent look toothless. The U.S. offense rarely consisted of more than endlessly circling the perimeter and firing speculative shots that had only the slightest chance of going in. Sure, Canada seemed to be saying, skate around as much as you like. But they turned the danger areas in front of Canadian goaltender Anne-Renée Desbiens into the Bermuda Triangle. American forwards entered and were never heard from again. It was not hockey to set the heart racing, perhaps, but it was devastatingly effective. The youngsters were getting punked. Again and again, they ran into the unbreakable wall of Canadian will. To be honest, the Americans never looked like they were going to score. The Canadian shorthanded goal early in the second period looked like the gold medal winner. It wasn't until the United States pulled their goaltender that one of their speculative flips goalward found more than Canadian red. It was Hillary Knight who tipped the point shot past a helpless Ms. Desbiens, because if anyone was going to drag the U.S. back into the game it didn't truly deserve to win, it would be America's own veteran. Ms. Knight is the greatest player in the history of the program. She's America's all-time leading Olympic goal scorer with 15 and the all-time Olympic points leader with 33. Heading into sudden death overtime with a 1-1 score was harsh on the Canadians. The rules of Olympic overtime pit 3 against 3 as opposed to the usual 5, which leaves more open ice and more space for the American speed and skill to exploit. So it proved. When American Megan Keller beat a Canadian defender with a beautiful deck that pulled her opponent out of position, she found herself alone with no one between her and Ms. Desbiens. She made no mistake. In this rivalry, silver often means nothing but heartbreak and disappointment. The Canadian women surely felt that way at the end of the game, as the end of the game horns blared and America celebrated. But sometimes a silver is more than second place. The Canadian coach, Troy Ryan, for one, still carried Canadian pride. For those that doubt and question this group, I hope once again they've shown why they deserve a lot of the credit that they've earned over many, many years of playing together, he said. And again, this particular article was by Mark Sappenfield, who is the senior global correspondent at The Monitor. Still from the world section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, "When governments pulled the plug on dissent, citizens from Iran to Uganda fight to stay online." Recent blackouts in Iran, Uganda, and beyond highlight a new front emerging in conflicts around the world, the fight to stay online. Though governments hold most of the power, people are finding ways to push back. The date on this particular article is February the 19th. It is by Ryan Lenore Brown, the Africa editor at The Monitor, Whitney Ulick, special correspondent at The Monitor, Scott Peterson, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, Valentina Gill, a special contributor at The Monitor, along with Sophie Neiman, also a special contributor at The Monitor, and finally, Akash Hassan, a special contributor at The Monitor. The dateline is Johannesburg, South Africa, Mexico City, Mexico, London, Caracas, Venezuela, Kampala, Uganda, and Delhi, India. After the January 3rd ouster of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, paramilitary groups loyal to the deposed leader's political movement began randomly stopping people on the streets of the capital, Caracas. They were searching for a type of contraband notoriously common in Venezuela, a virtual private network, or VPN. Often installed as software on a cell phone, a VPN masks a user's location, allows that person to bypass government restrictions that keep large swaths of the internet blocked here. It's a clear indicator of someone looking for information beyond what the government tells them is true, says Iria Puyosa, a senior research fellow at the Atlantic Council's Democracy and Technology Initiative, who has lived and worked in Venezuela. Venezuela's paranoia about what its citizens might find and share online is not unique. In 2024, the most recent year for which data is available, there were 296 internet shutdowns in 54 countries, according to the watchdog Access Now. Most were implemented by the country's governments or at authorities' behest. Experts agree these blackouts are becoming more frequent, but in recent weeks, as shutdowns have rocked countries from Uganda to Iran, a parallel trend is also clear. Citizens are fighting back. For now, anyway, the state still has the edge. Internet shutdowns are an expression of power difference, says Tony Roberts, co-editor of Internet Shutdowns in Africa, Technology Rights and Power. They can only be carried out by powerful people on people with less power. In nearly every country, the state either directly controls telecommunications infrastructure or regulates the private companies that do. That gives them almost unrestricted power to decide when the internet stays on and when it goes off. On January 8th, as 11 days of protest in Iran morphed into widespread calls for regime change, its government decided to flip the switch. At 8:30 p.m. local time, internet access plunged from nearly 100% connectivity into a total blackout, according to NetBlocks, which monitors internet freedom. Under the cover of this digital darkness, Iran security forces moved in, massacring protesters. By mid-February, 7,015 Iranians had been confirmed dead, with 11,744 possible additional fatalities still, quote, under investigation, according to the Washington-based human rights activist news agency, which has tabulated accurate casualty numbers in the past. Just days after the internet went off in Iran, Uganda's government announced it was also pulling the plug. On January 13th, 2 days before the country's presidential election, the Uganda Communications Commission ordered all mobile operators to shut off service. In a letter, the commission thanked operators for upholding national stability. But many observers saw a more nefarious aim, to sever the online ties between opposition candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, better known as Bobi Wine, and his Generation Z base. A former pop star with a flair for online self-promotion, Mr. Wine, along with his team, has long used the internet to rally supporters in a context where offline opposition members are routinely harassed, beaten, and arrested. Young Ugandans aren't the only ones using the internet to mobilize. In 2025, Gen Z demonstrators used the internet to rattle the gates of power in Nepal, Morocco, Madagascar, Kenya, Togo, Georgia, and Peru, among others. Anger was fomented in Facebook groups, and Discord servers spilled into the streets. Crackdowns were fast, deadly, and often aided by the virtual tear gas of internet restriction. Gen Z's fluency with digital tools has certainly reshaped how contemporary protest movements organize, mobilize, and communicate, says Tomiwa Iori, a senior researcher in the Technology Rights and Investigations Division of Human Rights Watch. He says that while it is far from the only factor contributing to the rise of internet shutdowns, young protesters have helped governments understand the internet as critical infrastructure for activism. That perception has made internet shutdowns more attractive. Some effects of internet shutdowns are obvious. In Iran, for instance, the slow return of connectivity was accompanied by a torrent of photos and videos showing what the regime was able to do when no one was watching. Now that things are coming back on, people are scrambling to put together the puzzle pieces of the truth, says Masha Alimardani, associate director of the Technology Threats and Opportunities Program at the New York-based human rights organization, Witness. Other effects of these blackouts are less immediately evident. In 2025, VPN industry watchdog Tupro VPN estimated that internet blackouts cost the countries that implemented them a collective $19.7 billion. These economic hits come in a variety of forms. During Uganda's recent shutdown, for instance, people who keep their money in virtual wallets found themselves suddenly unable to buy food or take a motorcycle taxi to work. Meanwhile, in India, Nasir Mir still lives with the consequences of a 2019 internet shutdown in the Kashmiri city of Srinagar, where he ran a courier service. When he was suddenly unable to organize deliveries online, his business collapsed. Since then, he has sworn off internet work. It felt like too much of a risk, he says. I lost confidence in running a business that depends on the internet. There was a personal toll, too. As the blackout stretched on, Mr. Mir couldn't speak to his brothers in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and the siblings couldn't reach him or their mother in Kashmir. For months, neither group knew if the other was safe. My mother cried nearly every day, he says. As internet censorship and shutdowns become more frequent, citizens are fighting back. The classic tool is a VPN, like the ones used by many Venezuelans. When governments block access to particular corners of the Internet, such as social media services, VPNs allow netizens to play a game of Internet whack-a-mole, disappearing from local servers and popping up virtually somewhere else in the world. But when the entire Internet goes down, so do VPNs. For a long time, that left most information seekers with one decidedly low-tech option. I kept myself informed by standing at my window, explains JV, a resident of Caracas, describing how he followed the aftermath of Venezuela's 2024 election. The monitor is not using his full name for his security, as government repression has increased in the wake of Mr. Maduro's capture. Now, offline messaging services like BitChat, which operates on Bluetooth, and satellite internet services like Elon Musk's Starlink provide more modern alternatives. During the Iranian protests, this was a game changer, Ms. Alamardani explained. A few days into the internet blackout, Starlink began providing services free of charge inside Iran, even though the service is illegal. Activists say the government succeeded in disrupting Starlink signals for the first 24 to 48 hours of the crackdown, which they believe was carried out with technology from Russia. But there are about 50,000 smuggled units operating inside the country, and they were able to beam out images showing scenes of overwhelmed morgues and people and police firing live rounds into crowds of demonstrators. But satellite internet isn't a free-for-all. For instance, in India, which has the dubious distinction of being the country with the most internet shutdowns in the world, government regulators have dragged their feet in negotiations to allow Starlink to operate there. Security requirements top the list of sticking points, says Apar Gupta, co-founder of the Internet Freedom Foundation, an Indian advocacy group. In other words, Delhi wants to know what Starlink will comply with its internet shutdown orders, he says. Services like Starlink also have their own gatekeepers. For example, while Mr. Musk's company was quick to make services free to Iranian protesters, the world's richest man was silent on the Ugandan government's suspension of Starlink ahead of the election there. If Starlink devices make it into India and Uganda, the company doesn't need government permission to turn them on. But for Mr. Musk, the business cost of angering these governments might outweigh the benefits of providing Starlink services. What we have seen is that this tool remains under the control and whims of owners and those who influence them from one hand, and local governments who are finding ways to jam this service from the other, wrote Hannah Kreitem, Director of Internet Technology and Development at the Internet Society, an advocacy organization, via a messaging app. Still, at least some of those doing the jamming appear worried about the future. In late January, Abul Hassan Firouzabadi, the former secretary of Iran's Supreme Council of Cyberspace, told Iranian media that his government's ability to control protests by turning off the web had a clear expiration date, one or two more years. Unfortunately, internet shutdowns will soon be obsolete, he said. And again, this particular article was written by Ryan Lenora Brown, African editor at The Monitor, Whitney Ulick, a special correspondent at The Monitor, Scott Peterson, a staff writer at The Monitor, Valentina Gill, a special contributor, along with Sophie Neiman, special contributor, and Akash Hassan, special contributor, all at The Monitor. Alrighty, here's one final article from the world section of today's Monitor. The headline reads, in response to Trump's foreign policy strategy, U.S. allies try, quote, de-risking. A great, quote, de-risking is underway in Europe in light of President Donald Trump's America First foreign policy overhaul. The date on this article is February the 19th. It is by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at the Monitor, and the dateline is London. A new policy mantra is taking hold among the United States' oldest allies as they address their growing concern about Washington's reliability as a partner. De-risking is the word they're using. And perhaps nothing better conveys the depth of their nervousness than the lineage of the term. originally coined by investment managers. It entered the political lexicon several years ago as shorthand for European countries' efforts to reduce potentially damaging dependencies on the West's most powerful rival, China. Now it's being applied to the relationship with Washington. In both word and deed, allies are embracing the de-risking as a common-sense response to President Donald Trump's America First overhaul of U.S. foreign policy. Just as Europe's de-risking with China deliberately stopped short of a full decoupling, which would have been impractical and potentially self-harming because China is Europe's second-largest trading partner, America's allies don't want and aren't seeking an outright split with Washington. The U.S. is the European Union's top trading partner. It's also the West's security linchpin, the core of the 80-year-old NATO alliance, which includes both much of Europe and Canada. Yet, a range of moves by Mr. Trump since returning to the White House has left allies questioning the long-term stability of their partnership. They've been unsettled and angered by the president's frequent, often unpredictable use of tariffs as a tool of economic and political leverage. On defense, Mr. Trump's European allies no longer see eye to eye with Washington on what they regard as the single greatest threat to Europe's security, Russian aggression. In seeking to broker peace between Russia and Ukraine, the Trump administration has signaled it is seeking strategic stability as well as revived economic ties with Moscow. But the Europeans fear U.S. brokered peace could in effect reward Russian President Vladimir Putin for invading Ukraine and embolden him to attack other European neighbors. The stability of NATO, meanwhile, was called into question for European allies by Mr. Trump's campaign to take over Greenland, the autonomous territory of alliance member Denmark. All that helps to explain why de-risking was explicitly deployed last weekend by political leaders and panelists at the continent's premier annual defense meeting, the Munich Security Conference. And there are growing signs the change in approach goes beyond mere words. A number of NATO members have begun looking at scaling back purchases of the alliance's premier stealth fighter jet, the United States F-35, in part because of a concern that they'll be left to rely on American manufacturer Lockheed Martin and the U.S. government to greenlight software updates and other future upgrades. Last week, Canada announced a new military investment strategy with the aim of redirecting funding, three-quarters of its purchases currently go to U.S. manufacturers, toward domestic suppliers. As part of this overall shift, it is also reviewing a planned purchase of up to 88 F-35s, only 16 of which it is formally committed to buying. Spain has recently ruled out buying the F-35. Germany and Portugal say they're still considering whether to go ahead with the purchases. Economically, too, there have been moves to de-risk. The EU, as well as Britain and Canada, have embarked on efforts to diversify their trade, negotiating a series of new agreements with India as well as other Asian and South American economies. European countries are also increasingly concerned about the dominance of major American companies in their technology infrastructure. In January, French Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu announced that government officials would no longer be using U.S.-owned applications like Zoom and Microsoft Teams for video conferencing. Instead, they'll be moving to a French-made system. This followed a directive in July for all French public sector employees to move away from using WhatsApp for work-related messaging in favor of a messaging app designed by the French government, expanding on an earlier order applying to government ministers and their staff. Austria's military has abandoned its use of Microsoft Office in favor of an open-source alternative, LibreOffice. Efforts also appear to be beginning in Europe to address the near-total dominance of Visa and MasterCard, both headquartered in the U.S., in the continent's card payment transactions. Last month, in the wake of Mr. Trump's efforts to gain control of Greenland, Aurore Laluc, the chair of the Economic Affairs Committee in the European Parliament, issued an urgent call for Europe to put in place a payment system of its own, arguing that Mr. Trump might otherwise choose to cut us off completely. While there is no sign other European politicians feel that's a real threat, Ms. Lalouk's social media post did chime with their broader sense of a need for de-risking their reliance on the U.S. In Britain this week, the country's major banks, alongside representatives from Visa and MasterCard, held an initial meeting on the establishment of a UK-based card payments company. If all goes well, the expectation is that it could be in place by the end of the decade. That points to a wider challenge for U.S. allies. The de-risking efforts will take time. As the allied leaders are all aware, the best-case scenario in the meantime is to reduce the urgency of getting them in place. That will mean engaging with Mr. Trump, doing all they can to keep relations on an even keel, and, if not fully repairing the Western alliance, at least keeping it from fraying further. And again, this particular article was by Ned Temko, who is a columnist at The Monitor. So with that, we're going to move on to the USA section of today's Monitor. And our first headline reads, "Who's in the Epstein files? From the former Prince Andrew to Lawrence Summers." The arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor makes the former prince the highest-profile person to face criminal charges related to ties with Jeffrey Epstein. But plenty of other big names are in the files of now public documents and facing scrutiny. The date on this article is February the 20th. It is by Cameron Pugh, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. The arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, formerly known as Prince Andrew, on suspicion of misconduct in public office, marked a significant development in the ongoing fallout from the release of documents related to the investigation of Jeffrey Epstein. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor is just one of many public figures facing renewed scrutiny over their relationships with the convicted sex offender, as details continue to emerge from the files about the various elite figures in Mr. Epstein's extensive network. Speculation about the extent of Mr. Epstein's ties to some of the world's most powerful people has swirled for weeks as the U.S. Justice Department has made more documents from its years-long investigations public. While other prominent people, from university professors to business leaders, have faced professional consequences from revelations about their connections to the convicted sex offender, Mr. Mountbatten Windsor is the highest profile figure thus far to face criminal charges. If convicted, the younger brother of Britain's King Charles III could potentially spend the rest of his life in prison. He also symbolizes a larger pattern. The fallout for people who associated with Mr. Epstein has been greater and faster for those outside the United States than within it. Other figures with known ties to Mr. Epstein have recently been the targets of scrutiny, but have yet to face any formal accusations of wrongdoing. They include President Donald Trump and former President Bill Clinton, among others. On February 14th, the Justice Department sent Congress a list of 300 people who appeared in the released files, which now totals some 3.5 million pages. The list named government officials or politically exposed people whose names appear in the file at least once. Being in the files did not by itself indicate wrongdoing. Some of those whose names are mentioned appear to have only had fleeting contact with the great disgraced financier who was found dead, hanging in his jail cell in 2019. The records comprise years of investigative material, not all of which appears directly related to Mr. Epstein or his criminal activities, and much of which has not been vetted. Yet the documents have begun to paint a clearer picture of the extent of Mr. Epstein's influence. He had numerous contacts at elite universities from Harvard and Columbia to Stanford, with celebrities such as filmmaker Woody Allen and New York Giants co-owner Stephen Tisch, with political figures such as right-wing commentator Steve Bannon, and with billionaire business leaders including Google co-founder Sergey Brin and Palantir co-founder Peter Thiel. News organizations are still combing through the documents to better understand who is mentioned in them and why. Here's a look at some of the prominent figures who appear in the files. Giselle Maxwell, the socialist daughter of publisher Robert Maxwell, she became Mr. Epstein's longtime associate starting in the 1990s. She was convicted in 2021 by a jury in U.S. federal court on sex trafficking charges tied to Mr. Epstein for her role in the recruitment and abuse of girls under 18. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. On February 19th, the former Prince Andrew was arrested on charges of misconduct in public office and accused by police of sharing confidential information with Mr. Epstein. For his part, Charles III issued a statement saying he supports a full investigation. Earlier, the king had stripped Mr. Mountbatten Windsor of his royal titles and forced him to move out of his taxpayer-funded residence in Windsor over longstanding accusations that the former prince had participated in Mr. Epstein's sex crimes. Virginia Giuffre, who died by suicide last year, had alleged that she was trafficked to the former prince and engaged in sexual activities with him at least three times before she turned 18. In 2020, Mr. Mountbatten Windsor settled a civil lawsuit with Ms. Giuffre for an undisclosed sum, but did not admit to any of her accusations. He has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing. Sarah Ferguson. Mr. Mountbatten Windsor's ex-wife has also come under scrutiny for her relationship with Mr. Epstein. In 2011, she publicly apologized for letting Mr. Epstein pay some of her debts and vowed not to ever have contact with him again. Later that year, she emailed Mr. Epstein and asked how she should respond to questions about their relationship. "I just want to make sure you are aware of this and seek your advice on how you would like me to answer," she wrote. Oops, one second here. I'm going down the list. Thorbjørn Jagland. Mr. Jagland, who served as Prime Minister of Norway in the late 1990s, was charged with, quote, gross corruption because of his relationship with Mr. Epstein. Emails show that the two men had a close relationship, exchanging notes about visits, sharing meals, and more. In one email, Mr. Jagland discusses staying at Mr. Epstein's apartment in Paris with an unidentified person who appears to be Mr. Epstein's assistant. In another email from 2014, an assistant discusses using Mr. Epstein's credit card to pay for trips for Mr. Jagland and his family to visit Palm Beach, Florida, and Mr. Epstein's private island in the Caribbean. Peter Mandelson. Mr. Mandelson resigned on February 2nd from the House of Lords after emails suggest he might have leaked confidential government information to Mr. Epstein. According to The Guardian, while Mr. Mandelson was Britain's business secretary, he forwarded the Financier a document intended for the prime minister that outlined a plan for a potential $20 billion or $27 billion asset sale. Britain's cabinet secretary is said to be investigating the emails. Catherine Rumor, Ms. Rumler. Ms. Rumler, who served as White House counsel under Barack Obama, announced February 12th that she would resign from her position as the top lawyer at Goldman Sachs after newly released documents suggested she had a close relationship with Mr. Epstein. In numerous email exchanges, she advised Mr. Epstein on how to push back on unflattering media scrutiny, including in the run-up to his 2019 arrest, and referred to him as Sweetie and Uncle Jeffrey. Emails showed she also accepted various luxury gifts from Mr. Epstein. Previously, Ms. Rumler has said that she only knew him in a professional capacity and offered him legal advice. Lawrence Summers. A Treasury secretary under Bill Clinton and a former president of Harvard University, Mr. Summers last year resigned from roles at OpenAI and stopped teaching at the university as it sought to investigate his ties to Mr. Epstein. Mr. Summers exchanged messages with the financier up until Mr. Epstein's death in 2019 and sought his advice as he pursued an extramarital relationship. The Harvard Crimson, the university's student newspaper reported that Mr. Summers and his wife, Elisa New, spent part of their honeymoon on Mr. Epstein's island in 2005, as police in Palm Beach had started to pursue a criminal case against Mr. Epstein. Last year, PBS said it would no longer distribute Ms. New's television series, Poetry in America, after revelations that Mr. Epstein had helped her secure funding. Also, here we go. Sultan Ahmed bin Sulayem. Mr. bin Sulayem left his position as head of DP World, a global logistics and port giant based in Dubai, on February 13th. For years following Mr. Epstein's first conviction, the two men corresponded by email, including about women. "Where are you? Are you okay? I loved the torture video," Mr. Epstein wrote to him in 2009. What the video was is unclear. Thomas Pritzker. Mr. Pritzker, a cousin of Illinois Governor B.J. Pritzker, announced he would retire as executive chairman of Hyatt Hotels to protect the company after documents showed that he had an extensive relationship with Mr. Epstein. The two men corresponded for years, new documents show, including making references to scheduling meetings well into 2018. Mr. Pritzker also wrote to Ms. Maxwell on numerous occasions. In 2023, the Wall Street Journal reported that Mr. Pritzker was a frequent guest at Mr. Epstein's townhome. Jean-Luc Brunel, the late French model scout, was accused by Ms. Gouffre of grooming girls for Mr. Epstein's sex trafficking operation. He associated with Mr. Epstein for years, but denied being involved in illegal activities with him. He was arrested by French authorities in 2020 and charged with the rape of minors. Like Mr. Epstein, he was found hanged in his cell before a trial could occur. And here are some other people who were named in the files. Again, showing up in the Epstein files or even visiting with him does not indicate wrongdoing. But a number of high-profile people have significant relationships with Mr. Epstein that are being scrutinized through the documents that have been released. President Donald Trump. Mr. Trump appears in the files thousands of times. He and Mr. Epstein socialized extensively in the 1980s and 1990s when they both lived in Palm Beach. An email from a federal prosecutor noted that Mr. Trump flew on Mr. Epstein's private plane at least eight times between 1993 and 1996. In an oft-quoted New York Magazine article from 2002, Mr. Trump described Mr. Epstein as a terrific guy and said he had known him for 15 years. More recently, Mr. Trump has said that he and Mr. Epstein had a falling out sometime in the mid-2000s, and he has denied knowledge of the financier's criminal activities. In early February, the Miami Herald reported that in July 2006, at the start of the investigation into Mr. Epstein, Mr. Trump called then Palm Beach Police Chief Michael Reiter and said, "Thank goodness you're stopping him. Everyone knows he's been doing this." He also called Ms. Maxwell evil. President Bill Clinton. Like Mr. Trump, Mr. Clinton socialized with Mr. Epstein frequently and flew on his private plane. The New York Times reported on February 8th, citing documents released by the Justice Department, that Ms. Maxwell played a key role in setting up the Clinton Global Initiative, an arm of the Clinton Foundation established in 2005. Both Bill and Hillary Clinton are expected to soon give closed-door depositions about their relationship with Mr. Epstein. They had originally resisted congressional subpoenas but bowed to pressure after Democrats and Republicans alike voted to hold them in contempt. The former president has said he cut ties with Mr. Epstein before his first indictment and has no knowledge of his criminal activities. Howard Lutnick. While he was a financial executive, Mr. Lutnick at one point lived next door to Mr. Epstein in Manhattan. Now Mr. Trump's Commerce Secretary, Mr. Lutnick, testified before Congress on February 10th that he and his family spent an hour on Mr. Epstein's private island in 2012, years after Mr. Epstein's first conviction for sex crimes. The files also show that Mr. Lutnick and Mr. Epstein exchanged emails in 2018. The secretary had previously said that he vowed in 2005 never to be in a room with Mr. Epstein again. Mr. Lutnick has faced bipartisan calls to resign. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told reporters the president fully supports the secretary. Steve Bannon. Mr. Bannon, a MAGA influencer and podcast host who was once one of Mr. Trump's closest advisors, appears to have exchanged friendly text with Mr. Epstein up until 2019. In several messages, Mr. Bannon advised the financier on how to rehabilitate his image. "We need to push back on the lies, then crush the pedo-trafficking narrative, then rebuild your image as a philanthropist," he wrote in 2019. In a statement to the New York Times, Mr. Bannon said his focus was on convincing Mr. Epstein to participate in a documentary that would destroy the very myths he created. Next, Elon Musk. In 2012 and 2013, the two men discussed the possibility of Mr. Musk visiting Mr. Epstein's private island. "We'll be in the BVI St. Bart's area over the holidays. Is there a good time to visit?" Mr. Musk wrote in 2013. Early in 2012, the Tesla CEO, and last year the leader of President Trump's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, asked Mr. Epstein, "What day, night will be the wildest party on your island?" It's unclear whether the visits ever took place. On his social media site X last year, Mr. Musk said that Epstein tried to get me to go to his island, and I refused. Les Wexner, the former chief executive of retail conglomerate L Brands, has faced scrutiny for his longtime relationship with Mr. Epstein, including tapping the financier to manage his fortune. One FBI document in the files names Mr. Wexner as a co-conspirator, though he has not been charged with a crime. Ms. Geoffrey once alleged that Mr. Wexner was one of the people she was trafficked to within Mr. Epstein's circle. Mr. Wexner has denied wrongdoing and has said he broke his ties to Mr. Epstein in 2007. He also accused Mr. Epstein of stealing money from him. He answered questions from members of Congress during a five-hour deposition in Ohio on February 18th. Bill Gates. Newly released documents include emails Mr. Epstein drafted to himself about the billionaire founder of Microsoft, suggesting that Mr. Gates had engaged in extramarital sex with Russian girls. It's not clear whether he ever shared those notes with Mr. Gates. Mr. Gates has called the allegations absolutely absurd and completely false. In 2021, he told CNN's Anderson Cooper that he regretted his relationship with Mr. Epstein. The New York Times reported in 2019 that Mr. Gates met Mr. Epstein numerous times beginning in 2011. The release files include numerous communications between the two men as well as photos. And again, this particular article is by Cameron Pugh, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Continuing along in the USA section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, "As AI leaps forward, concerns rise that innovation is leaving safety behind." A Defense Department dispute with Anthropic and warnings from artificial intelligence researchers have thrust AI safety issues into the spotlight. The date on this article is February the 20th. It is by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. When the United States military captured former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in January, it used an AI tool developed by a private U.S. company. It's unclear exactly what the tool did, but the company's policy says its products can't be used for violence or to develop weapons. Now the Pentagon is considering cutting ties with that company, Anthropic, because of its insistence on limits for how the military uses its technology, according to Axios. The tension between AI safeguards and national security aren't new, the tensions, rather, but multiple events in the last month have brought the issue of AI safety, in context ranging from weapons development to ethical advertising, into the spotlight. A lot of people who've been involved in the field of AI have been thinking about safety in various forms for a long time, says Miranda Bogan, the founding director of the Center for Democracy and Technology's AI Governance Lab. But now those conversations are happening on a much more visible stage. This month, researchers resigned from two major U.S. AI companies, citing inadequacies in the company's safeguards around things like consumer data collection. In an essay February 9th titled Something Big is Happening, investor Matt Schumer warned that AI will not only soon threaten Americans' jobs en masse, but that it could also start to behave in ways its creators can't predict or control. The essay went viral on social media. While urging action on very real risks, many AI safety experts caution against overplaying fears about hypothetical scenarios. These moments of public attention are valuable because they create openings for the kind of public debate about AI that is essential, Dr. Alondra Nelson, a former member of the United Nations High-Level Advisory Board Body on Artificial Intelligence, wrote the Monitor in an email while attending a global AI summit in India. But they are no substitutes for democratic deliberation, regulation, and real public accountability. In December, President Donald Trump issued an executive order blocking onerous state laws regulating AI. For example, his order singled out Colorado's law that bans algorithmic discrimination in areas like hiring and education. The president's order was supported by Republicans who said forcing AI companies to comply with excessive regulations could leave the U.S. at a competitive disadvantage with China. That sense of competition appears to be central to Anthropic's move away from the Pentagon. Anthropic wants to ensure its technology is not used to conduct domestic surveillance or develop weapons that fire without human input. But the Department of Defense, which stated earlier this year that the U.S. military must build on its lead over our adversaries in integrating AI, wants to deploy AI technology without regard to companies' individual policies, according to reports by Axios and Reuters. We constantly face pressure to set aside what matters most, wrote Rinkank Sharma, an AI safety researcher, in a publicly posted resignation letter from Anthropic last week. He did not refer to a specific event that led him to resign, but warned that, quote, our wisdom must grow in equal measure to our capacity to affect the world, lest we face the consequences. Dr. Bogan says policies designed to compel AI providers to subject their models to certain tests or to invest in safety are often diluted into disclosure requirements or non-binding recommendations. The incentives are so strongly in favor of moving forward quickly, even when there's a desire to put up guardrails, she says. Those warnings of AI's dangers have sometimes used existential language. Zoe Hitzig, a former researcher at OpenAI, cited deep reservations about the company's strategy in an editorial she wrote for the New York Times last week, fearing its decision to start testing ads on ChatGPT creates a potential for manipulating users in ways we don't have the tools to understand, let alone prevent. Mr. Sharma's resignation letter from Anthropic warned that the world is in peril. Some experts say such language is counterproductive. I find the framing of that point of no return to be very disempowering, said Dr. Bogan. She does worry that as people choose to turn over more of their decision-making to AI and learn to use the technology in their jobs, they're creating dependencies that will be increasingly difficult to untangle. But, she says, people are ultimately responsible for their choices and actions. I don't think we'll ever get to the point where it's truly impossible to make decisions about how to treat this new technology, she says. Catherine Elkins, an AI safety investigator for the National Institute of Standards and Technology, says she hopes she's wrong about some of the risks she sees, like an AI chatbot potentially using someone's data to manipulate them. But until she's sure, she wants safety to remain an urgent priority. Personally, I have felt it's better to err on the cautious side and devote my time to thinking about the risks of AI than to think that technology won't get better. And again, this particular article is by Caitlin Babcock, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Still from the USA section, our next headline reads, Is Instagram addictive? Mark Zuckerberg faces questions in court. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified in court on a hot issue for U.S. families, the risk of social media, especially for teenagers. The date on this article is February the 18th. It is by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Meta platform CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified in a Los Angeles court Wednesday about accusations that Instagram is exploiting young people and harming their mental health. His company is on trial alongside Google in a civil suit seen as a test case for holding tech companies to account for social ills blamed on their products, particularly among young users. The plaintiff is a 20-year-old woman who has said she became addicted to Instagram, owned by Meta, and YouTube, owned by Google, as an adolescent, and that her mental health suffered severely as a result. Meta has argued that her mental health struggles were caused by other factors, including family circumstances. Two other social media platforms, Snapchat and TikTok, settled for undisclosed amounts before the trial began. Mr. Zuckerberg was questioned on the stand by Mark Lanier, the plaintiff's lawyer, about Instagram's controls on children under 13 using the platform. The app requires users to be 13 or older, but didn't start asking new users to input a birth date until 2019. Mr. Zuckerberg defended its policy as appropriate. The plaintiff has said she began using Instagram aged 9. I don't think we identified every single person who tried to get around age restrictions, but you're implying we weren't trying to work on it, and that's not true, Mr. Zuckerberg said, according to news reports from the courtroom. Mr. Lanier also pressed Mr. Zuckerberg about goals set by Meta, the parent company, to maximize the time users spend on Instagram. Mr. Zuckerberg said its policy has evolved from time goals to the utility and value of the platform, he said. There's a basic assumption I have that if something is valuable, then people will do it more. The lawsuit tries to sidestep the broad protections that tech platforms enjoy against being sued for user-created content. Instead of arguing that Instagram was liable for harmful content, it accuses the company of designing an addictive app it knew could prove harmful for teenage girls. If Instagram Meta loses the case, it could prove momentous for social media companies. They face a wave of lawsuits that allege that their platforms are deliberately hooking and harming young users. Separately, Meta has been sued by New Mexico's state governments for allegedly not stopping online predators targeting minors using Instagram. Meta denies the allegation. Last week, Adam Mosseri, the head of Instagram, testified in the Los Angeles trial. He defended the company and said it weighed different considerations in vetting Instagram features, which include photo filters that mimic the effects of plastic surgery. Instagram had an internal debate about whether to permit these filters, according to court documents, before allowing them to be used. He also asserted in court that social media isn't clinically addictive. Australia recently became the first country to ban social media access for under 16s. Several European countries have weighed similar legal restrictions. Matthew Bergman, a plaintiff's attorney, said in a statement that Meta's own safety teams understood the dangers its platform posed and that Mr. Zuckerberg's testimony carries profound weight for families who have been waiting for their voices to be heard. Parents who say their children's mental health was harmed by social media gathered outside the courtroom before Mr. Zuckerberg arrived. He had previously been quizzed about child safety on his platforms during congressional hearings, but this was the first time that he'd been called to testify in a courtroom. And again, this particular article was by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. With that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to join me and listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor. Stay safe, stay well, stay hopeful, and I will be back with more from the Christian Science Monitor for you next week. Thank you for listening.